Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strohlig right here on LA Talk Radio.
And are you ever?
You are.
I am. It's 76 degrees in Los Angeles today.
You sound like one of those 70s FM guys. It's 77.
No, he sounds like soft porn when they do the bad dialogue at the beginning. I heard you needed your pipes fixed. Totally soft porn 70s.
I never believed any of the letters in your column until an event happened to me that I feel is truly worthy of your pages. Every Penthouse Forum started with that exact thing. Why are we talking about porn?
I don't know. That was a quick get-in.
You know why? Because Jane Brody, we're going to have Jane Brody on the air, and that's why we're talking
about porn.
She said that the idea of this turned her on.
Yes, she did.
So, by all means, I hope
she's in her 90.
We'll find that out shortly enough. Okay, let's pay the bills, Michael, shall
yes,
we?
Yes, indeed.
Let me do it.
Let me do something for the love of...
We'd like to thank our sponsor, Breakdown Services.
Go ahead. Give me that.
Read Paul.
We'd like to thank our sponsor, Breakdown Services, the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit BreakdownExpress.com. That's BreakdownExpress.com.
We would also like to acknowledge, ladies and gentlemen, PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts in Southern California.
You're going too fast.
We're grateful to Performing Arts Live for lending their support to our live arts calendar.
Better.
All right.
Better.
My turn. Three guests today. Actually, far more than that if we count each of Candy Milo's personalities. First up, joining us via telephone, she's the author of The Actor's Business Plan, a career guide for the acting life. She's also an award-winning casting director for a little film called Fargo and has taught acting for 30 years, a specialist in all forms of auditioning. We're delighted to have Jane Drake Brody with us on the phone in just a few mere moments.
And joining us right here in the studio, ladies and gentlemen, we honor the season of The Witch with two ghoulishly talented performers currently on stage in 3D Theatrical's critically acclaimed production of The Addams Family. Please welcome Bronson Pinchot and Candy Milo's on her way.
Pinchot.
What are you looking at me for?
I don't know, because I figured you'd give him a dirty look. I'm not going to do it. It's like when you drive in Italy and you cut off a driver, the girlfriend gives you the dirty look.
Yes.
The man is above such things.
Yes.
I always look for it. Yeah.
Okay.
I got cut off my first, and Jane will appreciate this because I know she's listening. We don't have a mic live yet, but she's listening. When I first got here from Chicago, I got cut off, and I said to the guy, "Where'd you get your license, Jagoff?" And we got to the light, and he said, "Roll down your window." And I said, "What?" He goes, "You from Chicago? No one around here says Jagoff." Which I thought was beautiful.
That is cute.
Candy Milo's on her way in?
I hope so.
All right.
I've left her a message.
Well, we'll see.
All right.
All right. Shall we just leap right into this, Michael?
I think we should.
Let's do that. Yeah. Our first guest is a nationally recognized expert in how to create a sustainable, happy, and rewarding career in the acting biz. Recipient of the Casting Society of America's Award for Best Location Casting for the acclaimed Coen Brothers film Fargo. She's also a Los Angeles Weekly's Best Actress Award winner and has performed on some of America's most prestigious stages, from the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis and Drury Lane in Chicago to Los Angeles Actors Theater. Formerly an assistant to Michael Shurtleff, author of Audition, she is retired from the theater school at DePaul University and was formerly head of undergraduate acting at LSU in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Her 45 years of professional insights and proven strategies are drawn upon in her new book, The Actor's Business Plan, A Career Guide for the Acting Life, which just launched on October 22nd. Please welcome Jane Drake Brody.
Hello, Jane. How are you?
I'm so excited to be here.
Are you? In Chicago?
I'm just shivering. It's wonderful.
and I
have on my pajamas, just so you know.
So it is a nighty thing, as Bronson thought.
Yeah, he's got a big smile on his face.
Jane, you're back east, right?
I am in Chicago right now. Actually, I'm in Michigan right now.
Oh, you're in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Oh, so Michigan's the Eastern time. It switches there.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure where that break fell. Anyway, Jane, it was October 22nd that the book launched, huh?
Yes, the book launched on October the 22nd, and it was quite magnificent, and we had lots of people selling, and buying, rather. I was selling them. And, you know, it's a book that I wrote because I had students coming to me every day, people calling me, asking me, what should I do about getting an agent, or what should I do about pictures, or what should I do? And I just started writing all those answers down, and little by little, the book came into being.
You know, what I'm most curious about, Jane, because I know you know as well as anyone that there's no shortage of these books out there. But the most interesting thing about reading the material here on the Actor's Business Plan is the mention of things like life and career plan rather than just career plan.
Yes.
So how does the book differentiate in that regard?
Well, there are all kinds of books that say make it and become a star tomorrow. As I've studied and as I've worked in the business for many years, it takes between 5 and 8 years, maybe even 10, for people to actually have a career. And I think people enter the business with the wrong idea that tomorrow they're going to have the career, or they just got out of school, they have a degree, they're going to have a career. So what my book does is take a model of planning your life so that you can have a career life, but you can also have a life like everyone else has, because you're going to. How do you pay your bills? How do you pay off and have a day job that you actually enjoy?
Right.
People get day jobs because they're waiting, and I think don't wait. Have a day job that you get some fun from so that you don't become a bitter old actor sitting around moaning and groaning.
Hey, I resent the reference to me.
Yeah. Poor me. And also it talks about having, you're going to have a love life. How is that going to affect
Is described in the book? Okay, send me a copy. I'm missing all
right
of this.
Right there. And also, you know, how do credit cards work? All those things that you need to know in order to be in a life that actors have avoided knowing.
Well, you know,
I mean, we... Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Continue. I don't want to cut you off.
I do.
I think that I was an actor. I think we actors avoid anything that have numbers attached to them.
Right.
Unless it's an audition number.
Right.
The rest of that, we don't know. We don't, the checkbook, we forgot that part. We forgot how much we owed. We put off having children. We put off getting any fun out of life other than quickly, live your career. And I think that is ultimately makes your career shorter.
Yeah,
I
think there's this whole sense of, and I think you're hitting on it, there's this whole sense in this business of preparing for something. We're always preparing for something. We're always rehearsing for something. And we're actually living the something at the same time.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
You don't pull the punches here, too, Jane. One of the things you say in this is it differs from other handbooks in that it addresses the everyday issues of life and jobs that so frequently destroy an actor's career before it has even begun. Are you just talking about that whole soul-sucking idea of just being miserable when you're not acting?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's true. I think there are a couple of things on that, Paul. First of all, people get jobs that they hate. And then they can't get out of them for auditions, which is kind of foolish.
Right.
And then they finally succumb to that job because they like the golden handcuffs, as it were. The other part of it is, I think, that actors will take jobs in theaters or tours or TV that they really don't like. And they keep them because, well, at least I'm working. And that may not be true. I think a career has got to be planned by the actor with a goal in mind. Where do I want to be in 5 years? Where do I want to be in 10 years?
Yeah.
So I put a 5-year plan out, because if you want to be in a sitcom in 5 years, you're going to make different choices every day than if you want to be on Broadway in 5 years.
Right, exactly. One of the things I'm so indebted to State University of New York at New Paltz, where I went to college, is that acting four, you never stepped on a stage. It was like acting one, two, and three were a craft, and then acting four was all the business side of things. It was all headshots and all that stuff, and I think that business side of thing is too often neglected.
Absolutely. Or treated as if it's something that is scary or difficult. Jane, and it really isn't. It may be big, but it's not that scary, really.
Right.
Jane, this is Michael Sterling, Paul's co-host. I have a question for you. Being that you're in Chicago and working as a casting director there, is it as competitive there as it is in Los Angeles?
I wouldn't say so, no. I think in Los Angeles, everybody and their mother moves there. Whether they can act or not, whether they're, you know, whatever, they move there. Whereas in Chicago, Chicago's a workers' town. Actors tend to live here and stay here. They may go by, they may be bi-coastal, as it were, Chicago, L.A. But I think it's a much easier place to live. We don't have earthquakes, mudslides. You can get places on public transportation.
Yeah.
There are middle-class actors still living here in Chicago. Yeah. And I think that the middle-class actor is being so squeezed out by stars. When I was a young person, I did voiceover for cartoons and things like that. Those are all done by stars now. It's getting narrow and narrower, I think, the chance to work in LA or New York. Right. And I think it's getting wider and wider, the chance to work elsewhere. I think that there's a difference between working as an actor and being a star.
Sure, especially with all of the with all of the tax incentives. I mean, look at Louisiana right now and at Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
These are hotbeds of production. I haven't said hotbed in a long time. Hotbed.
We've got five sitcoms. We've got five shows shooting here.
You got
not
five.
To mention,
there's five shows in Chicago.
I believe so. Yeah. When I last counted.
Unbelievable.
Plus, commercials.
You know, Jane, here's another question, if I may. Having written this book, do you feel that actors who read it will believe that you are more accessible to them, especially those who are living in your city?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm pretty accessible anyway.
Are you?
Oh, my God, yeah. I'm on Facebook. I'm wherever they want to be.
Well, that's awesome, because
yes,
well, she's not the case in Los Angeles.
She's not a casting director now. She's retired.
No,
oh,
but,
okay.
Any of the casting agencies in Chicago, there's only five big ones, four.
Right.
They're very accessible. It is not like Los Angeles, where everybody's behind huge buildings and thousands of assistants.
Mm-hmm.
It really is much more friendly atmosphere.
Mm.
Lots of support for Chicago actors in Chicago. Really a lot of support. I think it's a... I lived and worked in Los Angeles for a while, and I never felt that it was supportive. It was nice. But Chicago is supportive of its own people, and also we have shows going to Broadway all the time from here. So I think it's a perfect place to be at this point in time. I think Seattle's doing awfully well right now as well. Atlanta's doing well. Philadelphia is doing well. I mean, in the book, I talk about different markets as opposed to not just L.A. and New York.
Right.
Because
right.
I think that actors need to realize that they haven't failed because they're not on a TV show.
Right. Yeah, no, and too much of the time, that's the yardstick. I also found, like, right after I got out of college, I went to Chicago, and it was far easier to get my union affiliations, get Equity and SAG and AFTRA. It was far easier to break that nut because it was a smaller, I hate to say small pond, but it was a smaller enough pond that it was easier to get that accomplished, you know. I want to put this out
there. I think I cast you in your first movie. Didn't I,
Paul? You did. Father.
You played a transvestite jailbird.
I was a gay guy in
Again?
Prison. I was a gay guy in prison who put the moves on Roger Daltrey. That was the first thing I did.
Yes.
Holy cannoli.
The screen credit was gay man in jail. And they said I was a fool to
Lord.
Dream. The book we're talking about, The Actor's Business Plan, A Career Guide for the Acting Life, is a Bloomsbury publication just launched on the 22nd. The website for aforementioned book is actorsbusinessplan.com, where you can hear and learn all about this particular publication. And I want to share one wonderful quote here. This is from Lucian Douglas, head of acting at University of Texas. The book promises to be an extremely practical and helpful guide for the young actor embarking on a professional acting career. I wish such a book existed when I was graduating. So love that. Jane, we're going to turn the mics over to our in-studio guests who are sitting here so patiently, but we thank you so much for taking some time out of your very busy schedule to talk about the book.
Absolutely.
Thanks,
Jane.
Paul. And they can get it on Amazon.
Oh, it's on Amazon.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Great.
Sure.
And we will throw that website out at least one or two more times before the end of the hour if anyone missed it. And thank you so much, Jane. Can't wait to see you. I'll be in Chicago in a couple weeks.
Stay warm.
Oh, you will be. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll get together.
All righty.
Okay.
See ya.
Thank you, Jane.
Bye.
All right. Wonderful woman.
And sounds very lovely.
She's just a doll. Wonderful. She's just a phenomenal casting director and just really just a wonderful person. Really.
Terrific. And, of course, our listeners will say it now. ActorsBusinessPlan.com is the website to go to for the book on Amazon. You can also get it there.
And, Michael, would you be kind enough to introduce this lovely gentleman to my right?
I'd be so happy to do
this. I don't want to be introduced.
You don't?
No. I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Or since he's doing such a great job, should he read his own introduction?
Yeah, give me the, give me it. I'll edit it as I go.
Oh, okay.
Our next guest was raised in South Pasadena, California. That's actually true. And educated at Yale University. Oh, this is because I wrote it. This is from my Playbill bio. Educated at Yale University, Circle in the Square Theater School, and Shakespeare and Company. Personal career favorites include Autolycus, and then there's a pronunciation.
Yeah,
Autolycus.
Autolycus. Did I not get that correct?
Not really, but it's Autolycus. In the New York Shakespeare Festival production of The Winter's Tale, and then there's a pronunciation, Winters. Charlie Caroline in the West End production of Stones in His Pockets and Lawyer Craven.
That's Poquettes.
Okay,
sorry.
But Poquettes. Here, I can't do anymore. I thought it would be one of those goofy ones I could make funny comments on, but I wrote it.
Oh, it gets goofy. Michael, would you read it?
And Lawyer Craven. I'm going to pick up where he said.
Yeah, but pick up the pace, Michael. Yeah. It's really, just give it some, you know, some energy.
Push, yeah. Okay.
In the West, it as erotic. Can you do it as an erotic reading, Michael?
Like really?
He can't help it.
Can.
Well, go ahead.
Yes,
go ahead.
I can. Yeah, we can go there. He first worked with Miss Rachel York in the film. He was Elliot Blitzer in Quentin Tarantino's True Romance.
I did not work with Rachel in any film. I worked with her in Sly Fox on Broadway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I hadn't started. Okay, I started after that.
You need some coaching, but go ahead.
I need a pill.
You should buy the book.
Let's go back. In film, he was Elliot Blitzer in Quentin Tarantino's True Romance, Serge in Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 3.
Not 2.
This weren't up for 2. Huh?
Eduardo in The First Wives Club and Barry in Risky Business, among many, many others. The alpha and omega of his character work in TV are the wide-eyed, innocent Balky on the series Perfect Strangers and a mass-murdering cannibal on NCIS. Please welcome the ridiculously talented Bronson Pinchot.
What is that?
A little rock and roll, baby.
So it just occurred to me while you're reading that, that this gentleman...
You don't want to know the research I did when I did play a cannibal. I actually know how human flesh tastes. I didn't taste it.
Yikes.
But I did...
I was told chicken tofu.
No.
Chicken tofu.
Veal. Supposedly it tastes like veal.
Really?
Yeah. And there was a famine in St. Petersburg in 1921 that was so bad that there's an actual picture of a husband and wife with a food stall, and on the food stall are frozen people.
Where do we go now that you've set the bar?
There is no place. But
people.
I had to play a cannibal, and he makes reference to how yummy people are, and I had on NCIS, and I wanted to know what it was like, and I was very sorry I knew, and I'm very sorry about what I saw, but apparently it worked.
I have the worst cannibal joke, and it's just, can I do it very quickly?
Yes,
sure.
But do it
very,
well.
Very quick. Okay.
Do it well.
Donner, Party of One.
Oh, that's...
Oh.
I like... That is cute.
Yes.
I really
hold on to
like
that.
Party of One.
Hold on to that.
No, it just occurred to me as we're reading through Mr. Pinchot's...
Yeah, be careful.
Ronnie P.
Reading through this, that he and his... screen partner in Perfect Strangers are responsible for two of my favorite movies, because you got the one that we mentioned, I should know this, True Romance, and then you also have My Favorite Year, which is there's two colossally wonderful movies.
I hired an assistant because of the demands of the Addams Family, and he's a 22-year-old kid who I love, but I call him Benji Stone because I'm running around with a rapier, and I'm being Bronson, and he's new to show business, and he always runs in three directions. I've actually seen a human being. I say, I need this, and this, and go get Rachel some tea. And he goes in six directions. He looks like a cartoon with a cloud around him. But he is Benji Stone.
Bring Alan Swan to Brooklyn. What are you ashamed of? Everything. That's the best line of the movie. What are you? Lanny Kazan, who we've had on the show,
has that great
line. What are you ashamed of?
Everything. Rachel York, we said her name, and he worked on Broadway with her in Sly Fox.
She's responsible for casting me in the Addams Family.
Yes, so I understand.
Really?
Yeah, I got a call, do you want to do a play? And I said, no, because they're a lot of work and they're no money, and sometimes people are mean. And then they said, but it's Rachel York. And I said, Rachel? And they said, and it's her idea that you be in this play. And I said, oh, what is the play? They said, The Addams Family. And I thought, well, I'm a little too tall for Pugsley, and I'm not interested in playing Fester, and I'm too short to play Lurch. And they said, you'd be Gomez opposite her, Morticia. And I said, yes, immediately.
Wow.
And she's,
so you didn't
She's
have...
so perfect. We're so perfect together, I have to say. It's funny to say you're perfect, but the off-stage chemistry is so amazing because she's very imperious, but in a beautiful way. And she tells me what to do, and I'm happy to do it. And that's the relationship on stage, too.
It astounds me that this is... I thought for sure that this was a go-to role for you, that Gomez was something you'd done...
I had no idea that it even existed.
Right.
But it was a very... As all the best things are, I was just at a costume fitting for a film, and the woman said, do you like anything? I said, I like this. I took it. I put it on. It fit. We were done. And that's what some things are like.
It was this.
I mean, she had like 20 outfits, but... It's made so much sense as soon as I heard it that I said yes, and my manager said, well, do you want to think about it? I said, no. You want to hear the dates? No. It's a great idea, and it is. It's been that way every day, every minute.
Now, how much of the like one of the things I wrote, which we didn't put in this thing in the bio here, but this other sort of predilection that you have, this fascination you have with
pre-1840 architecture.
I saw a couple of those, and it's fat. Are you working on one actively? Do you always have one going on? For our listeners, tell them.
For the love of God, let me answer one question at a time. For the love of God.
I knew this was going to be long. I just knew this was going to be long.
Rescue pre-1840 buildings when they are condemned or they have to be moved or something like that. Take them apart, label them, and store them so that they don't get thrown in the burn heap. And then later on, I not only reconstruct them, but I reinvent them. So I built a house that was made of 22 abandoned houses and a church. But when you look at it, it looks like it's always been there. And inside and outside, all the surfaces are original.
So you hobbled together a house from other houses.
That's right.
Wow.
I started because I lived in an early house, and it was lacking its original floor, and it was lacking its original entryway. And I had floors and entryways, and I thought, well, I'll just see if I can splice them like Frankenstein. And it looked so well. And someone actually came through the town I was in and said, I date that house to 1830. I said, do you? Because I put it up in 2011. But
wow.
That's a thing I really love.
I never heard of restoration.
But what I do is I keep the original surfaces. Most people don't do that. So if it's got a blistered, old, painted surface, I leave it. And that is what, when you drive by, you think that's got to have been there for 200 mm-hmm. years. And inside, too. Foot-worn floors, I leave it. If it's warped, I shim it so that it stays warped.
And do all the homes have to have belonged to cannibals? Or is that
That's
just
cute.
Something that...
It's not a laugh-out-loud cute, but it's cute. That's very nice. Now, I'll tell you something.
I just got to tell you, if you were watching, the eyes just remained completely dead on that. I got nothing. It was very off-putting.
My eyes are never dead. No, yeah. I was teasing.
Bronson Pinchot has a doll's eyes. Black eyes.
I will say, apropos of that, one thing that happened working with old houses is that I completely lost my sense of being spooked by anything because it just went away one day. And it was absolutely as a result of that, because everybody thinks old houses are haunted and they're scary and they creak and they've got... But once I started saving them, I stopped believing in any of that stuff.
Were you naturally skittish before that?
Yeah,
were you
I was.
Like a jumpy guy?
I was. The first old house I moved into, every time the stairs creaked, I would cross myself, but once I spent time deeply getting into the fabric of them, taking them apart nail by nail, saving the nails because they're hand forged and all that, I lost completely. Even once in a while, I try to scare myself. If I pull over to the road to pee in Vermont or something, I think, well, there could be a hand sticking out of the ground. I think, well, as long as it's pointing to a house, I really don't care. But I used to be kind of skittish.
Really?
I lost it completely.
Really? Well, I
like your hair. Do you have like a moose in it, or is it just a blow dry situation? No, it's very nice.
It is nice hair, isn't it?
It's sort of nice.
I'm working
on nice,
this
beautiful color.
B. Arthur thing. I'm working
as a
on
B. Arthur.
That.
You need the shoulder pads.
Yeah. There's a wonderful Tom Waits song called Falling Down.
Sing it.
No, it's
just saying I didn't mean it.
No, not for free, Sam.
I don't work for free.
No, Falling Down. It's about, and all it is about them tearing down an old hotel and taking
that
all the door.
That must never happen. It's so easy to save everything, and in most localities that have an Amish population, they'll come and take all the beams away and all the framing members and reuse them.
Really?
There's no reason to tear early buildings down and just put them in a dump.
Well, I just did a show at the Will Geer Theatricum Botanicum out on Topanga.
Yeah.
And that was what Will Geer had built when he was blacklisted. He actually built this little theater on his farm there for Woody Guthrie lived there and all that. And I found out in the last week of the show that the stage was when they destroyed the Santa Monica Pier. They took all of
Absolutely.
The beams from the pier, and that's what built the stage.
There's
there.
No character. There's nothing like it for character and you know, beautiful emotion. This kind of thing. It's beautiful stuff.
And you can't. So you're not really a laminate floor guy, then.
I would eat my own vomit before I would put. As a matter of fact, I remember when I had my show on DIY, the Bronson Pinchot Project, and they said, "Would you come on Good Morning America and talk about trends in building?" I said, first of all, I don't know what trends in building are. Secondly, if I did know, I would puke. I'm not interested in trends unless the trend is from 1835.
Right.
And then I'd like to put it in my living room. But trends? Trends? A trend is a thing that's over next week.
Right.
I don't get it. I like wavy old glass. You know, I like to look out and everything's all kind of Lucy in the sky with diamonds. Oh, that's beautiful stuff.
Where I grew up in Connecticut.
In Connecticut?
Ridgefield.
Oh, yeah. Lovely area.
Congregational church there.
Yeah. Greek Revival?
1740.
Oh, no, that's way earlier than Greek Revival. That's
1740. And it's at the intersection of a place called George Washington Highway, which is where George Washington joined with Rochambeau and basically where the French helped us win the Revolutionary War because we had no money. So that's sort of where the financial thing. But we're talking about Adam's Family, aren't we?
We are.
But it all dovetails.
Itself out. But trends, I wanted to just address that point. Yeah. Trends, I think, you know, I watch HGTV, and I think trends are, by what I see, granite countertops and stainless steel.
Stupid.
But it's been going on for a long time. So that trend is probably coming to an end very quickly.
But trends do come to ends.
Yeah.
Trends come to ends. It reminds me of the bumper sticker I wanted to, in the 80s, when Nancy Reagan was going around saying, just say no to drugs.
Yes.
And also faux finishes were way too ubiquitous. I wanted to do a bumper sticker that said, just say no, N-A-U-X, to faux, F-A-U-X.
No.
Just say no to faux.
See, the thing is, you wouldn't even have to finish
No one would get it, which is why I would not be able to do it. But I had, remember when they had all, I have an honor roll student on board, baby on board?
Yes.
A friend of mine, wonderful actor named Curtis Armstrong, and his wife put a plank in the back of their car, and the sign said, board on board.
Board on board.
Yeah, board on board.
And the one that I saw that I loved. The one that I saw that I loved was, no baby on board, just plow into me.
What? Love that.
Makes about that much sense.
I want to introduce...
You should be more careful driving around me because I have a baby as opposed to just plow right into me.
I want a courtesy horn, the one that you have to use when the person in front of you is not making the left because they're texting. Because you can't use your regular horn that's like, I hate you. It's got to be, hi. Hi. It's going to be a little gentle courtesy horn.
But did you ever see that comedian who said, you can never be mad at anyone when you're driving a Volkswagen? Because it's like, you mother meep! You got meep! It's a little ass horn. Remember the way the Volkswagens had?
Yes.
It was, we weren't sustaining or anything?
Yeah.
I think this is what we need to do.
What?
Cell phone use in cars, okay, but your driver's license has to be your phone number. That way, if you really want to get someone who cuts you off, you could call them directly.
I need for the radio listening audience to understand what Michael's face was like just now. His mouth was open in an attempt to smile as he tried to grasp what the humor or meaning or portent of that was. And it was exactly what I was thinking.
Think about it.
I can't think about it because It's great.
You can call the people rather than
Well, you're talking about the license plate, not the driver's license. You're
right, the license plate.
You meant the license plate. You said the driver's license. So Michael and I and 68,000 listeners were left out of the call.
And no one could process that? No one could fix that error audibly?
Michael and I together have a 400 IQ, and we were lost. Now, I want to tell you something funny that is typical of my life. When your beautiful first guest was talking, I was sitting making notes because she said, if you think you're going to get discovered overnight, it never happens. And I was discovered overnight. I really was. I was living in a flop house in a real old flop house in Hollywood. Beverly Hills Cop came out on day one. Day two, people were screeching to a halt and trying to grab me and do things. What was the other thing? If you think you're going to... Every single thing she said, I thought, yeah... Not really, but I'm not going to write a book because.
But you have to admit that your situation.
No, the story of my life was completely weird because I went right from welfare to starring on TV.
Right,
but I was grinning because I kept thinking, all right, so I'm not going to be writing the book flap blurb for this book And the other thing is, you know, the idea of planning. See, I don't believe in planning. I never plan anything. I will show up for a movie and not have a single idea of what the character is. But by the time I've looked around and seen what people are doing and who's playing my wife and who's playing my kid and what the thing is, I get a great idea in the moment. And I never have planned anything in my career.
Really?
As a matter of fact, whenever I did try to plan, it didn't work. But that's just me.
Yeah, no.
That's why my book is very short.
What is your book called, Bronson?
Just Let It Happen. Let It Happen and Have Some Tissues, because it can be very sad. If you get your heart set on something.
You finished that, because you worried me with tissues.
No. I remember, I can't remember this director's name, but years ago he came to me and said, I think you have what it takes to be a musical comedy star. I'm going to put you in the Broadway production of Big. And at the last minute, he decided to go with the unknown guy who had done the workshop. And I was extremely offended. Big then went on to be, at that time, the biggest money loser in Broadway history. And I wasn't in it. And then I later got in musicals that were written for me, where I had a wonderful time. And so if I did get very upset, but there was no point. If I tried to plan that move... Right. And it ended in tears. And his death. He didn't die because of me, but he did die. Well, he deserved it. He deserved to just drop dead for being mean to a young actor. But anyway.
Where did Moon Over Buffalo?
No, that's a Carol Burnett play.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with me.
Weren't you in that?
No, I was in the audience cheering her on.
I thought you did that.
No, I did not do Moon Over Buffalo.
Where are you getting that information?
Oh, I thought God, for some
so
reason
sad.
I put it together
Michael,
in my
who
head.
Who does the research for this? Very nice man. No, but any time...
I don't do research.
Or I'll give
I'm
you
just
another example.
In the moment.
You were talking about... Very cute. Now, that I liked. Beverly Hills Cop 2, only I wasn't in it
so
because...
Just right
which you listen to.
Show like spit. Okay, so...
I was at the gym, and Jerry Bruckheimer and Tom Cruise were there, and they were trying to get me to – Tom was just helping him because they were friends. And Jerry said, you got to do Cop 2? And I said, I don't know. And he said, we'll get you out of that little series you're in. Done. I had nothing more to say. Don't insult my series. Get me out of that little series I'm in. I don't want anything to do with it. Anyway, Tony Scott – was the director of Beverly Hills Cop 2. And a few years later, when I really needed to make a big change in my career, when Perfect Strangers was done, True Romance came around, and the first thing he said to me was, I'm absolutely going to do whatever it takes to get you in this movie because I missed the opportunity to work with you on Beverly Hills Cop 2. So somebody saying something insulting at a water cooler, I mean, I didn't make a big scene. I just said, I want nothing to do. No, I have nothing to do with an approach like that. But then it panned out and led to True Romance, which is now a big cult thing. There's a convention every year at the Safari Inn, which I host for people that love it, and they all show up dressed as. But that doesn't matter.
This is a phenomenal movie. It's a great story. The characters are so rich. It's got one of the best fight scenes of all time between
Patricia
Arquette and. James
Gandolfini. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's very hard to watch.
Oh,
it's all brilliant.
Oh, yeah, but it's just wonderful.
It's extraordinary.
And the way she flips it too. It's just
it's a great movie. And I wrote her recently because I hadn't watched it in 20 years, and I watched it at the Safari Inn, and I was astounded by her performance. Because when we were kids, when we made it, we were all in our late 20s, early 30s, whatever it was, I was so wrapped up in my own character, I didn't really grasp what she was doing. And to see it, you know, as an adult, I was so amazed. She's very sweet.
Who directed True Romance?
Tony Scott.
It was Tony Scott. Okay, yeah. Because Tarantino... Had he directed by the time that was, because he wrote the script, but
right.
Had he directed by the time that was filmed, or did Reservoir Dogs come after that?
Reservoir Dogs came before it.
It did?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think it was probably, the deal was made before Reservoir Dogs, whatever it was. Actually, they had been in cahoots for a long time, according to his wife.
Okay.
Tony had given him lots of input on movies, and then he had shown the script of True Romance to Tony perhaps before he'd ever made his other movies. Okay. So it wasn't like Tony was preferred over him. I think Tony was in bed with that movie for a long time. But Tony had a unique way of directing, which was he would stand right next to the camera like a silent film director, not in what they call Video Village, and he would emote with you like a silent film director. He would either go where you went, which he did with me, or he would try to get you somewhere. He would do it. He would throw up. He would cry. Do it. Whatever you were doing, he would do it with you.
Wow.
Such a committed director. Mm. Well, look at the performances in that movie. I mean, that's all Tony.
Oh, yeah.
The level of just going way beyond what you're safe or comfortable with, that was Tony.
Way beyond in a big way and way beyond in an intensely small way. And I'm thinking, of course, about the Christopher Walken, Dennis Hopper
astonishing
scene.
Astonishing.
Which is such perfect economy. There's nothing mm-hmm. extraneous in that. And you watch that scene under a microscope and just find
it's amazing.
New stuff every time. Mm.
It's amazing. Some of it was ad-libbed. Not a lot, but some of it was. And that's another thing that Tony was quite something.
Yeah. Great loss.
That's awesome. I'm sorry that I can't speak about that because I haven't seen that film.
But you can speak
about
it.
You haven't seen True Romance?
We should talk about that.
Yes,
I'm very sad you haven't seen True Romance. It's a linchpin of American culture.
I will make a point of it. Yeah. I'll make a point of it.
It is.
I can come to the Safari Inn and see it, right?
With you there? Yeah. I'm always there. It's really fun.
All right.
So the Addams Family. You're halfway through this jaunt with Addams Family.
Two thirds
right?
of the way through.
You're at one. Or you're moving to locations.
We're moving to the Redondo
we
Beach
open
Performing Arts
yes,
Center
on mm-hmm. October 31st. Fittingly,
yes, Saturday night.
It's a beautiful venue, quite different from the Plummer Auditorium, which is very historic in Fullerton.
I'm fond of the Plummer.
Yes, I know.
I would
imagine you are.
I am very fond of it. It's endearing.
It would make sense.
What's that?
Restoring houses, it would make sense.
No, it's just endearing. There's no it's small and cozy, and you have to really squeeze around things. But I like that. It's a nice house.
Yeah, yeah,
very nice house.
And working with the beautiful Rachel York.
Yes,
and the lovely
invisible Candy Milo.
Yes,
who is just
she just texted me.
What did she say?
She thought it was tomorrow.
Oh,
and she took a voiceover job today, so she's making money.
Okay.
Bless her heart. She's
so
cute. She's playing grandma in this and made up to look like an unearthly hag. And believe it or not, she guest starred on Perfect Strangers 30 years ago.
Yes. I saw that.
When she was just a child, and we were both in our 20s, and there we are now playing ghouls. But it's fun because we have a lot of in jokes that go over even our heads.
Did you remember her? In all honesty,
yeah.
Did you remember her?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, because I mean, Perfect Strangers was on so long. I would imagine that you just
I had run into her about 10 years ago, and she reintroduced herself, and I did remember her. She was very good. It was a very good episode. She was a young Italian mother, and there we were doing our thing. But she was sweet. But it's funny.
She's how quite things the, come around. Quite the scene stealer, this Adam Sandler yeah. thing, huh?
Yeah.
She's, well, you know what? The show is, and I say this unbiasedly, it really is a very funny show. I'd never seen it before mm-hmm. until opening night.
I've still never seen it.
And
have you seen it again since opening night?
I haven't. I will
oh, because
on Saturday.
It was, that was yeah. A very... safe, you know, we really, it was like the third time we'd done it, so you have to see it again if you really want to see what the show is.
Well, first of all, it's beautiful to look at.
Well, it was a little shaky to start.
It wasn't shaky, but it wasn't shaky. It was confident, but part of that confidence was not coloring outside the box.
Right.
And once we got it in our bones,
where you could play,
and, especially yeah. me, I create once the audience is there. Before that, I lay the bricks, I put some mortar on, and I smooth it out with my finger, but I didn't really know what I, you know, unless it's Ibsen, if it's an audience pleasing piece of material, I don't know what to, I can't think how you could possibly develop what you're going to do till the audience.
Well,
is
and
there.
That's
this that. Is an audience pleaser. Mm-hmm. It's vaudevillian.
Very much.
It's big.
That's
it's,
the Gleason mindset. That's the Jackie Gleason mindset.
Never understood when people say, well, I can't see what you're going to do here. I say, they'll tell me. Well, they'll tell me. If they don't like it, I'll do something else. If they do like it, wild horses won't get me off it. But they tell you. I mean, I have a hunch after 30-odd years, but it's still fun to feel that when you can always feel when you've got them.
Right.
Sometimes it takes 5 minutes, sometimes it takes 10 minutes, sometimes it takes 30 seconds, and then you slightly lose them if there's something a little off color. You find a way to do it funny instead of off color, and you just hone it. But, I mean, I studied the method. It's not that I don't believe in that stuff, but in an audience-pleasing show like The Addams Family, which is just like almost like an English pantomime, there's nothing... there's the audience is part of the play.
Sure.
And while it's an empty house, I don't know what to tell people. What are you going to do there? No idea. They'll tell me.
Yeah. No, they used to talk about that. I mentioned the Gleason thing. They used to talk about that all the time. The reason he didn't like to rehearse is because it's like the other character is not there.
Exactly.
The other character is the audience.
Right.
You know, and it makes for incredible spontaneity, too, because you haven't played it out. Or
no,
or
you,
locked
have no
into line
you have no
or
idea.
Like
and anyone that says, you know, and that's why breaking the fourth wall is such a powerful thing to do, why Shakespeare does it all the time, because they really are there. And if you're pretending there's a fourth wall... that's like me pretending that you're not here
yeah.
and I'm just talking to Michael. Mm-hmm. No, it's not
yeah.
It's not so. And they're there. You're in one big room. The stage is not the limit of where you are. It's the back wall of the theater, and everybody in the theater is in it with you. And that's the way it was when the greatest drama ever and comedies ever were written, and it hasn't changed. This whole thing of, you know, I mean, it's great. That's the reason to do stage. Otherwise,
sure.
you go do NCIS and
exactly.
research cannibals.
How do you enjoy going back to singing as you are?
Well, I love it. I mean, telling a story through singing is an exciting and great thing to do. I'm lucky in that all the songs I sing in the show actually are monologues of what's going on in my head. I don't have any numbers in this show as I normally do, which are just, here's a funny patter song that we found from another show and we gave you. Which happens. Yeah. When I did Anything Goes, they went into the trunk, the Cole Porter trunk, and they found a lot of funny songs and gave them to me. They didn't advance the action. They were just marvelous to do.
Right.
But all of Gomez's songs, because Gomez is torn between his wife and his daughter in this play, are really inner monologues set to music. And I love it for that, because I have to pour out what I'm feeling in song. It's weird. There are not any kind of useless... but adorable comedy numbers, which is what I normally get.
They're not fluff. They're actually...
not at all.
They serve the narrative, yeah.
I must say this on behalf of being a spectator and removing myself from being associated with the show professionally as a publicist for it. The one thing that knocked me out about your performance, quite frankly, was A, I certainly knew you sang, and I hadn't heard you sing for a long time. And I said to myself, man, is he singing good. That was
Thank
the
you.
First thing that crossed my mind. And then as the show progressed, he brings to this very character-driven show so much heart to his character and the relationship that he has with Morticia, who is Rachel, and Wednesday, who is the daughter, who actually is kind of the plot of the story. And that's something that I found totally fascinating because it locked the reality in of those two characters mm-hmm. and the meaningfulness that he had as a father for his daughter who was going through an issue, which is bringing a regular person home for dinner and exposing that person to her kooky family.
Right. The challenge of this play is the Addams Family was originally single-cell cartoons. That's how it works great. They're ghouls. They live in this house. There's a joke. It's done. You turn the page. When you do, and to some extent it's true of the TV series too, you just have a situation you play it out. But when you do a play, you have to actually, you have to tell a human story, whether they're the Addams Family or the Pinchot family or the Sterling family, it doesn't matter. Mm. And what was a challenge in this is that some of the characters are traditionally kind of monolithic. Mm. I mean, the whole point of Wednesday is she doesn't crack a smile. And the whole point of Morticia is that she's regal and and so it fell on Gomez to run the gamut a little bit between them, which was interesting. I mean, at one point I thought, how do I connect the dots? And then I said, forget about connecting the dots. Because if I'm driving along singing to the Beach Boys, and then I see a car accident and I jump out and pick up somebody, and then, you know, you go from joy to sadness and back again. The other day, my sister's roommate, we thought he'd had a stroke, but he just had low blood sugar. Rushed off in a hospital. We were all horrified, low blood sugar. So we went from having a good day, having a terrible day, having a great day in 20 minutes. Wow. Mm. And, you know, so sometimes connecting the dots is overrated.
Well, what's not overrated?
I must also say also that because I hadn't sung in so long, our conductor and musical director, Corey Hirsch.
Yes.
I said to him, I'm not so confident. I haven't sung in so long. I feel really rusty. You must know a great coach. And he said, I'm a great coach. So he took me off to Cal State Fullerton, where he teaches, and put me in a room with a piano and said, I know you can do this, but you really are kind of rusty. And he just got me back to where I wanted to be. And it's unique because there he is right in the pit. So if there's any, there's ever a difficult, I mean, there's my teacher right there.
Right.
It's unusual because what he said, which I have seen before, he said a lot of people learn how to get away from their bad habits and they can sing beautifully in the shower and then they get on stage and they go back to the bad habits. Right. But there he is right there. I'm not going to undo what he did. He's right in the pit. So it's been really amazing.
How long had it been, Bronson?
10 years.
10 years.
Yeah.
And what was the
last
thing that you sang?
I sang in a musical called Chasing Nicolette, which is based on the medieval story of Nicolette and Aucassin. But that was one of those shows where they just gave me patter songs, and I just spoke when I needed to speak and sang if I thought I had it and didn't have any sustained notes and that nobody cared. Right. But this is different. But it's so amazing. It's to have your very own, right there. Yeah. With you, and I wouldn't dare.
A little bit of security.
It's not security because he wants me to go beyond where I'm comfortable. But at least if you're going to go beyond where you're comfortable. There he is, right there, giving you the look like you know you can do this. Just do that. That's great.
You know, I
wouldn't dare fake it.
That's also wonderful too because it just goes to show the relationship that you have with him. Because there's a lot of people who would be in that exact situation and be like, "Oh yeah, but my voice teacher is right there, so it has me more nervous." Because,
oh no,
you know,
he's a beautiful soul, and they're all like that in this group, 3D. Yeah. The director is T.J. Dawson and Corey. Well, they're very. Very actor friendly. I mean, they'll go through it with you.
Yeah. They're nurturing too, aren't they?
Very nurturing.
Yeah. And very familial feeling down there.
Oh, it's so great.
Because it is a family at the core.
It's sensational. Yeah. So, you know, these texts go back and forth, and I say, I want to kiss Rachel's arm here. And I get a text back. Well, if you think you really must, then try it. But it's all in good fun. It's wonderful. I mean, you don't do that. When I did Sly Fox with Rachel, we worked with the great director, Arthur Penn, and he is a curmudgeon.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
That man is a curmudgeon. He's brilliant.
Yeah.
But he will not let you do I'd like to like adjust my glasses. No. I'd like to take a poo. No. I mean, he just won't let you do anything. And TJ is an actor, so he understands actors.
That he does. And he's a very good actor. Have you ever seen him on the stage?
I know, but I can imagine because he's got such a big heart. He's wonderful.
He does. Yes, he does. We need to tell people how to see it. And we also need to get from Bronson. Did you tell him about
how we closed the show? We only have 2 minutes.
All right. So
I love when there's only 2 minutes.
Let me give the information here. Ladies and gentlemen, opening this weekend on Halloween, October 31st at the Redondo Beach Performing Arts Center, which is 1935 East Manhattan Boulevard in Redondo Beach, beautiful Redondo Beach. Come down early, have some great eats in and around that area, which there are plenty of wonderful restaurants. And the show will play at 8 p.m. this coming Saturday and a matinee on the following day, Sunday, November
1st. Isn't there a show Friday?
2 p.m.
I know there's a show Friday because we're doing our tech today.
Yes, I'm so sorry.
You are so sad that you let that out. No one will come Friday.
Let me back that up. There is a show on Friday at 8 p.m. And you can get tickets quite easily by going to the box office, either there at the Redondo Beach Performing Arts Center or by going to the online site 3D, as in David, 3DTshows.com. And group and student discounts are available, or you can certainly call the remote box office number, which is 714-589-2770, extension 1.
Don't forget to tell them Sundays is in the jacuzzi with the stars.
Sunday!
Nice.
We got 1 minute, Brian.
What do you want to do?
A onstage performance, not necessarily this show, an onstage performance mishap, something embarrassing, something that happened, something that went south during performance.
When I was in Sly Fox with Rachel, I was out there. I was really out there. The director wanted me to be, and I was. And I was doing a scene. The play took place in the Wild West in 1885. And someone's cell phone rang, and I said, "Oh, I'll get it." Big laugh. And then I said, "I'm terribly sorry. The phone hasn't been invented yet." And we resume Sly Fox currently. It's great fun because everybody hates cell phones. Since I told that one so fast, that one of the performances of putting it together, Carol Burnett had laryngitis. She couldn't go on. As soon as that was announced.
What show was this?
Putting it together.
Dean Butler was in that, wasn't he?
No. Yeah. Anyway, as soon as it was announced that Carol wouldn't be on, a woman in the very front row opened the New York Times to find another show to go see, and I was singing a song on the lip of the stage.
Wow.
So I got on my stomach with my hands cradled in, my head cradled in my hands, and sang to her as she went through the paper, completely unaware that I existed.
Oblivious.
But everybody was laughing at this witch,
who
was closer to me than you are. And I was there, and I was just sick right into her face.
I just love that.
Well, she got what she deserved because she finally figured it out.
No, think you're just on a screen.
Yeah, they think you're just a tomato.
What a pleasure. What a pleasure, Bronson, having you on
the show. Indeed. We could do another hour.
We could. It's just, I'm sorry that we didn't have candy.
Yes.
But it's so nice.
Oh, you have candy?
It is Halloween.
We've all had candy.
Lady! A pleasure. A great time, Michael, as always. And
thank you,
Paul. Thanks to Jane Brody kicking off the hour for us. And
see you on the radio.
See you next week.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strohle right here on LA Talk Radio.